This summer, till we see you all in September. With grief stricken. Okay, 98-2955. Acher versus Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund et al. Mr. Russert representing the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Russert, and I represent the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund and Wisconsin Healthcare Liability Insurance Plan in the case that's before you today. The case involves the question of whether or not the minor child statute of limitations in medical malpractice claims is constitutional. It's constitutional in this case. The plaintiff respondent's claims are barred no matter which statute of limitation you apply to it. And the minor child statute of limitation incorporates the adult child statute of limitation. The claim is barred because the claim was filed beyond the 10th birthday of the plaintiff. It was filed more than 5 years from the date of the alleged act or omission. It was filed more than 3 years from the date of the injury, and it was filed more than 1 year from the date of discovery. So no matter how you analyze this case, it is barred. The statute is constitutional under the procedural due process, under substantive due process, under equal protection, and under Article 1, Section 9 of the Wisconsin statute.
What was the injury?
The injury was the alleged failure to follow up on a diagnosis at birth. At birth, the child's pediatrician noted that there was a poor red reflex in the right eye. There is testimony in this case through the mother who represented that her treating physician told her that within 6 months, this injury was complete, that the child developed a blindness in her right eye, which was uncorrectable.
So how quickly could the little girl have sued?
She could have sued at the moment that she knew or should have known that she had an injury.
And when was that?
In this case, the blindness wasn't discovered until she was 10 and a half, but I'm arguing that I believe that she could have discovered it at any time from the time that it developed to age 10.
Well, her parents could have discovered it. Right? She
could have discovered it.
Yeah, but her parents could have discovered it when she was 6 months, 1 day old, theoretically.
Correct.
She was blind as of 6 months, 1 day, or thereabouts. That's by the time she was 1 year old, was she blind in one eye?
That's what the treating physician has told the mother, yes.
So she was blind, but they didn't know it.
That's correct.
That's the state of the evidence? Or at this is a summary judgment, right?
Yes.
As of the summary judgment. That's not disputed?
It's not disputed.
Okay.
So this was an omission. The doctor should have told. In other words, we have a diagnosis. We had a birth. There was this notation in the chart, and the doctor omitted.
The doctor put the notation in the chart.
But what did he do with it?
We don't know. We'll never know. The doctor's deceased. That's
right.
One of
I understand that. 4 years later, but the point is, was there any? Obviously, there was an obligation to tell. Was this an omission? There was a diagnosis. There was not treatment. That's
correct. There was diagnosis, but there wasn't treatment.
I want to make absolutely sure I understand this. The child was legally blind in one eye at 6 months or very close to that?
Legally, clinically, the child was, the disease process had developed to the point where she would have been blind after 6 months in the one eye. Correct.
Yeah, that's the
Well, now, is that true, or is it that the treatment had to be done in 6 months?
Right.
Otherwise, there would be progressive blindness. Which is it?
Well, I can tell you that the mother testified that the treating physician told her that if this problem hadn't been corrected within the first 6 months, that her blindness was set, there was nothing they could do, nothing to correct the problem.
This is like the but-for when you have a malignant melanoma. I don't want to even bring that case up, except this is the Erlinger, you know, the question whether but-for the person when, if you didn't treat it within a certain time, the person either was going to die because the cancer had metastasized or hearing, what you're saying is, even though she went on to school, exhibited some clumsiness or allegedly, I think the words of the trial judge, cheated on the eye exam, nothing could have been done at that point. It had to have been done 6 months.
That's correct.
From the time that the doctor noted this.
So when would she have discovered this? When would she have known that she was blind?
In one eye.
At six months and one day, or was this a gradual deterioration?
It's my, you know, I don't have the answer to that. My understanding from the testimony in this case, which was undisputed at summary judgment, is that the mother testified, the treating physician told her that after 6 months, there was nothing that could have been done to correct the problem.
Well, let's just take it a step up. What did she discover after she was 10 years old?
At about age 10 and 3/4, she had an eye exam done where one of the testers noticed that she was looking from behind her hand or cheating to read the board.
Okay, so when he or she tested the child properly, was the child legally blind in one eye?
Child was blind in that eye.
So if whatever happened before that, at 10 years and 3/4, the child discovered she was legally blind in one eye. That's your position.
The child and the parents, correct.
Right. And then, so your position is then there was a statute of limitations of 1 year from discovery.
That's correct.
Is that right? And since there was a statute of limitations 1 year from discovery, and she discovered and had time, she had 1/4 of a year, she could have brought the injury, the lawsuit. That's your position?
No, my position would be that she would have been able to bring the lawsuit any time before September 10th, 1994.
September 10th, 1994. Okay, and
she discovered the blindness. The blindness was discovered on September 10th, 1993.
Okay, that's, and she did that. So, in other words, she had time. She had approximately 1 year from the date of discovery, 93. She had 1 year to bring the lawsuit.
That's my position. That's correct.
And that's the 1 year from discovery is the statute of limitations.
The 1 year of discovery is actually found in 893.55 and is part of the statute which discusses the discovery rule and the statute of repose for all medical malpractice claimants other than children up to age 10.
And so you have mixed statutory repose and a statute of limitations in your opinion.
You have a mixed statute of a mixed discovery rule statute and statute of repose. That's correct.
Okay.
But in any event, your initial commentary, under any circumstances, all of them would meet the criteria for being, quote, constitutional. I mean, I'm talking about...
That's correct. And the under the due process analysis, the statute is constitutional because the plaintiffs are claiming, plaintiffs respondents in this case are claiming that the cause of action hadn't even accrued before it was extinguished. And there's case law to establish. The Hunter case at 97 Wis. 2nd 435 establishes that an unaccrued cause of action is not a constitutionally protected property right. And if there's no property interest in the cause of action, then the legislature can extinguish that cause of action. Further valid under the due process analysis because this statute of limitation was passed by the legislature and the legislative process itself is the due process that's required by the Constitution. It's constitutionally valid under the substantive due process because the statute has a rational relationship to the underlying legislative purpose. And the legislative purpose was presented to the court in the plaintiff respondent's appendix at pages 135 and 144. And what the legislative history tells us is that at the time that this law was passed, the legislature was concerned with large reserves needing to be set aside by insurance companies for injuries to young children, that they observed a delay in causes of action being brought for young children. The delay required insurance companies to set aside large reserves and keep those reserves set aside until the cause of action would be brought. And at that time, before this legislation was passed, minor children had until age of majority plus 1 year to bring the cause of action. Therefore, the large reserves for an injury at birth might have to be kept there for 19 years. This resulted in higher insurance premiums for health care providers and, in turn, higher costs of health care for the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. So the legislature said, what we're going to do is we're going to apply a general medical malpractice statute of limitations, 3-year statute of limitations, to all medical malpractice claimants. But we will carve out a special exception for children before the age of 10 and create a balance of the needs for those very young minor children to have their injuries analyzed and discovered and brought to court against the needs of the general population of the state of Wisconsin to have quality and affordable health care. So it meets the substantive due process as there is a rational relationship to the statute itself. This law was passed in 1977. Later in 1979, the legislature took a look at the statute for the general claimants in medical malpractice, 893-55, and responded to this court's urging in a couple of cases to expand that, to make it longer than 3 years. The court had said in a couple of cases that the 3-year statute of limitations was too short for medical malpractice claimants. And the legislature responded by creating the 1-year discovery rule. In 1979, 4 years before the Hansen Court created the discovery rule for all other tort claims, all other tort claims that didn't already have a legislative mandated discovery rule.
Counsel, how is this case different than Makos with regard to the issues presented?
In Makos, the claim was that the woman could not have even discovered her injury, that she wasn't even injured until her cause of action expired. In this case, the young lady was injured. She could have discovered it. It was there to be discovered.
And I know, and that was one of the reasons we had a discussion of the CLL case in terms of the cause of action. Being extinguished before it's even discovered. But I'm not so much, my question should be more focused. How does this differ from Makos in terms of legal arguments? I know legal arguments flow from the factual arguments, so you've given me the factual distinction. Is there any other factual distinction that's significant for the legal arguments?
Well, you know, and I'm not so sure that you need to distinguish this from Makos. I'm trying to think of the answer to your question. Makos is a very unique bird. I mean, it's a 2-2-2 decision. There's no plurality. I don't believe it has any precedential effect. You have two justices that ruled the statute was unconstitutional. Two justices that said that the statute didn't apply because diagnosis wasn't treatment. And two justices who said it was constitutional and diagnosis is treatment. It's an evenly split court, and I don't believe it has any precedential effect. The legal differences between this and Makos, in Makos, the woman's cause of action hadn't been completed before it was extinguished.
Completed in the sense of discovered. In Makos, she didn't discover it before the repose.
Well,
right?
In fact, my understanding of Makos is that the injury hadn't even occurred. The cancer hadn't metastasized. There was no evidence to indicate that cancer had metastasized.
But there was cancer. That's injurious in and of itself. I mean, if you are diagnosed
with
malignant tumor, that is an injury. It is more injurious, of course, if it metastasized. But clearly, that is a disease, and it is troublesome. I assume. I think you'll make that assumption.
Yes.
Okay. And the problem, just looking at the fact situation, Makos, that before there is a discovery of the disease, and that in legal terms is before the cause of action accrued, she is barred from going to court, right?
That's correct.
All right. Now here, and I note that in your Court of Appeals brief, or in Mr. Aiken's Court of Appeals brief, there's a question as to when she knew, whether it was her fifth year or not. Here, if you say the discovery is September 10, 1993, if that's true, and I'm not asking you to concede that, then there's been a repose before that, right? Because it's after 5 years from the omission.
And beyond her 10th birthday.
So if the repose statute is valid, she's out.
That's correct.
The only reason you say 1 year from discovery and she's in is if you separate those statutes and the first part of the repose is unconstitutional or invalid and the second one survives, right?
So, as I see it,
the fact situations are the same as in Makos. And Makos is not an unusual fact situation. It is usual. That is, there is no discovery of the physician's malpractice, whether it's diagnosis or treatment, until after the 5 years have elapsed.
That certainly is a circumstance that can repeat itself with respect to statute of repose. That's correct.
Repeat, and it doesn't matter what the disease is.
That's correct.
Okay. So why, to make this, regardless of the reasoning of Makos, in Makos, the plaintiff won and got a shot at proving malpractice.
Only because the case was remanded to the trial court.
That's right, got a shot at that. Why shouldn't this client, if going to be treated the same as Makos, and we agree the fact situation is the same,
I would disagree.
Okay, why isn't the fact situation?
Again, I think it's important that in this case, the injury could have been discovered over and over again in the Makos case.
Okay, that's a fact.
Yes.
Okay, if I agree with that, and that may have to go back for trial as to when it's discovered. But if we assume that the jury would say it was not discoverable, then it would be exactly as Makos.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
All right. Why should the result be different for these two clients?
I don't know that we're talking about results. I think we have to analyze whether the statute is constitutional or not. In Makos, the reason it was sent back was because he had two justices saying it was unconstitutional and two justices not reaching a constitutional decision but saying that it was not.
And so you should look at Makos again, and therefore you're not.
Well, I don't think Makos decides this case, and I don't think that this case rests on Makos.
All right. Are the legal arguments any different than in Makos?
I don't believe so.
Are the legal arguments then the same as in Makos?
I think they're very similar. And for example, under the Article 1, Section 9 analysis that the court will have to consider if it considers whether this statute is unconstitutional. It's been established by Mulder at 95 with second 173 that there's no legal rights conferred by that particular section of the Constitution, that the state has the right to extinguish a cause of action before discovery, and that's no violation of Article 1, Section 9, and that's the CLL Associates case, and that if there's no violation to extinguish an accrued cause of action, as was the court's decision in CLL Associates, where there's a vested property right, then it would seems to me to be illogical to say that the court finds it unconstitutional to extinguish an unaccrued cause of action, as in this case, where the cause of action was unaccrued by the time it was extinguished. Under the equal protection analysis, Strykowski upheld that medical malpractice and healthcare providers is a unique classification, that the court can look at it and acknowledge that the legislature has addressed it in a unique way, and that it's constitutional because the classifications, although not perfect, are somewhat fungible. The courts have expanded the classifications to include podiatrists, to include dentists. I know the plaintiff's respondents have made an argument about whether or not psychologists are fall underneath the ambit of Chapter 655, and yet the court's never addressed that. At some point, the court may address it and may decide that they are.
What do I do with this? I mean, I know the legal arguments. This is a loaded term, fundamentally unfair, because it's a term of art, but let me use it kind of generically. It just seems unfair. It just seems unfair that, especially with regard to a child, it may be unfair to an adult, but I'm just saying it just seems unfair to a child to hold a child of such tender years to this law. And by doing that, to wipe away any remedy just seems unfair.
Statutes of repose, by their nature, will be unfair in certain circumstances. It's the legislative decision to extinguish claims, as I discussed before, in this case, to reduce the cost of health care to the citizens of Wisconsin, to ensure affordable quality health care to the citizens of Wisconsin. And yes, statutes of repose have harsh results. It's unfortunately, the legislature has made that the determination, unfortunate for the court, because the court should be bound by their decision. It shouldn't be the province of the court to step in and say, we don't agree with your policy decision, we're going to change it.
So that's your response. In other words, it may seem unfair to me, but this is what the legislature has done, weighing the policy considerations.
Well, if you think about the total fairness of it, medical malpractice claimants are the only claimants in this state who have unlimited funds in which to recover for their damages. Somebody's hit by a car, you are bound by the limits of their insurance. They may not even have insurance. The legislature has created the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, my client, and the Wisconsin Healthcare Liability Insurance Plan to create insurance and unlimited funds for claimants of medical malpractice.
I know, but it seems unfair in this case.
It would seem unfair to a person who's hit by a car to be limited by insurance, and yet a claimant for medical malpractice has unlimited funds from which to recover. So there's a balance.
Yeah. In the plaintiff's court of appeals brief, the plaintiff said as follows: no one disputes that neither, is it Amy? Amy, nor her parents. No one disputes that neither Amy nor her parents knew of the injury before her fifth birthday. Thus, her discovery period was long gone, even if she would have discovered her injury at 8 to 9 years old. There is, at a minimum, a disputed issue of material fact as to when Ames' parents should have discovered her injury. Now, do you agree that neither Ames nor her parents, no one disputes that neither Ames nor her parents knew of the injury before her fifth birthday?
I would say that's undisputed, that they did not know of it before her fifth birthday.
Oh, and so the dispute is, which should they have known?
So they could have known it.
Okay. All right.
And I think that argument is particularly addressed to whether or not the one-year statute of one-year discovery rule applies in this case. And I think you can sever it, and I think it should be severed if you find the statute of repose to be unconstitutional.
Right, but even so, it goes to the issue of when did the cause of action accrue. If you can discover it or should have discovered it, then your cause of action accrued and you had a fair chance to break it.
That's correct.
Which would distinguish it from the fact situation in Nakos.
That's correct. Again, it's because they could have discovered it in this case. I see my time's up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Aiken.
Good morning, Justices.
You were the counsel in Makos?
I was the counsel in Makos, yes. I visit once again on this same issue. I think first we should clear up this discovery discussion. The question under the law is not whether or not the injury is discovered, per se. It's whether or not the claim is discovered.
What's the difference?
The difference here is that
if there's no injury?
Well, if Amy could have figured out that her eye was bad, what would she have known about that? She wouldn't have known that she had red reflux. She wouldn't have known that Dr. Harris should have diagnosed red reflux. She wouldn't have known that Dr. Harris apparently did diagnose red reflux but didn't tell anybody. She wouldn't have known that Dr. Harris didn't treat her red reflux. And she wouldn't have known that red reflux was treatable so that she wouldn't have been injured. So the only thing she would have known is, you know, I don't see real well out of my eye. And there's probably a whole bunch of classmates that didn't see real well out of their eyes. I happen to have one short-sighted, one long-sighted eye. Apparently I've had it my whole life. I didn't know it until a year ago. Because this eye sees things long. This eye reads well. I never knew I had two different eyes. So to presume that because her eye doesn't see real well, that somehow she's supposed to know that she's different than the other kids whose eyes don't see well, I don't think is a fair play.
Well, that goes back to that oil case where you not only have to know that you've had damage, but that you have to put it together with who caused it.
Yeah, or at least that someone caused it. So she would have not known any of those things. So, and then we...
is this bad or eye or is this blind?
This eye is legally blind. I don't think we have an eye that has a dark shield over it. We have an eye that is a bad eye.
Okay.
Well, I think
so
people with glasses can be characterized legally blind without glasses.
No, true.
Right.
Okay. Her eye is not correctable to beyond legal blindness.
And when was that found out?
That was found out at 10 and 3 quarters age.
When did she find out that she had a claim?
Well, as I understand the process, they first of all, they noticed their daughter was clumsy, which I'll submit since my younger brother was an all-state baseball player and has been blind in one eye since he was about 4, that had nothing to do with being blind in one eye, but it's one of those coincidences. So they noticed that she was clumsy, so she took Amy to Stein Optical. That was when it was discovered that she didn't see out of the eye. Then they took her to an ophthalmologist, and the ophthalmologist said, oh my goodness, this is caused by red reflux. This should have been diagnosed early on in this child's life. Then the records were obtained, in which event it was discovered that the red reflux was noted in the records. And that would be when I would maintain, either when the ophthalmologist said it should have been discovered if his statement was that strong, or when the records were obtained, when it was clear that it had been diagnosed but hadn't been followed up.
What were the dates of those?
Those are in our brief. Jim, do you think you can find that?
Well, September of 1993, 3 months before the
That would sound... That would sound right, September 1993.
That's when she discovered the connection of her blindness to the red reflex?
No, that's when Stein Optical occurred.
Right.
It was sometime thereafter that the investigation began.
Well, is it a year after that? Half a year? 6 months? And how long did it take them to get the records? They go to an ophthalmologist, that's a 4-week appointment, 8-week appointment.
You filed this case when? In 1996, correct?
April 30, 1996.
Did she know that she had a claim against this doctor within 1 year prior to the date of your filing?
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm unable to answer that. My understanding is that the lawsuit was filed when it hit our offices fairly timely, meaning quickly. Of course, I want to address this 1 year. The statute 893.56 provides that whichever statute gives the claimant the longer period of time controls. That's the clear wording of the statute. You look at the statutes, one provides 5 years, the other provides 10 years. They're both statute of repose. Under the clear wording of the statute, there is only one reading. The 10-year birthday rule controls the filing of this action. So this child was given until her 10th birthday to file the action. It's undisputed that mom and dad, and for that matter Amy, since no one knew about red reflux or anything else, discovered this action after that 10-year time limit ran. There's nothing about 893.56 that provides relief then after the 10 years by a 1 year rule. The only way you can even bring up 1 year is if you say, well, we're the defendants, but we're going to assume the 5 years is unconstitutional, so that doesn't count anymore. But that's not how the statutes read. It's 1 year/5, but no more than five. That's the earlier one. 10 years is the later. The statute says we apply the later. So now we apply the later. And the problem with the later is that her statute was, a repose was invoked before she could have, before they reasonably discovered it, discovered their claim. I think under the fair reading of Tomczyk versus Bailey, that a number of justices commented that the difference between Tomczyk, where a statute of repose was allowed to stand, was because the people had actually discovered their injury about somewhere between 7 and 12 weeks before the statute of repose would have barred their claim. That and a number of justices in Tomczyk commented upon the fact that that made Tomczyk different than Maples.
Yeah, except if just counsel, just in Tomczyk, that's true. And here your opposing counsel is saying, well, wait a minute, there was still 1 year, basically, from the, I'm not talking about the repose, I'm talking about the 1 year statute from the time of the discovery until, I think that was in, well, opposing counsel, at least I wrote it down, September 10th, 93 to September 10th, 94, that was that 1 year period.
Well, that's when they knew of the injury, certainly 93, but...
Isn't that, okay.
No, because that statute, the 5 year, 1 year rule, by its wording, does not apply to this claim. Without regard to constitutionality, it doesn't apply to this claim. It clearly says it's within 1 year discovery, but not more than 5 years. How do we now take what the legislature said in black and white and say, we're going to pretend the 5 year rule doesn't exist? Because that was what you have to do. It's stated black and white. Secondly, the 893.56 says we apply for children whichever statute gives more time. The more time rule is 893.56, which does not have a discovery rule. It clearly has no discovery rule stated in it. So by the black and white of the law, we are looking at 56. We're not looking at 55. And it's distortion to loop back into 56 and say, well, now that we think that we can't support the five-year statute of repose, and now that we realize under 56 that there may be a problem if you don't discover an injury within the 10-year statute of repose, we're going to loop the loop back in and say we're going to ignore the plain wording of the statute. And I don't think that's fair. I mean, if we're talking about fundamental fairness, a client ought to be able to look at the statutory scheme and say, this is how it plays out.
Sorry, but I'm having trouble. trouble with your argument on 893.56, okay? Mm-hmm. 893.56 refers back to
893.55. Yes.
It says, any person under 18 shall bring an action to recover damages for injuries to the person arising from treatment or operation performed by a health care provider. It says you have to bring it within the time of 893.55. Okay?
Yes.
Or by the time that person reaches the age of 10, whichever is later. So, person did not bring it within 10, right?
Well wait, it's whichever is later.
Okay, well, you didn't get to 10. You didn't bring it within
10. We didn't bring it within 10.
Okay, so now we're back to 893.55.
No.
Why?
Statute says whichever is later.
Okay.
Which is later? Not 5 years. We're out of 5 years.
Well, why?
Because by the plain word of the statute, it's 5 years or 1 year from discovery, or 5 years, or not more than 5 years. We're out of 55. We're out of 55 when the kid turns 5 years and 6 months or so. We're gone.
You're out of 55, and then you're out of 10 years. So where are you? You're out of both.
That's right. We're out of both, and therefore, if we're out of both, the question is 56 enforceable under equal protection, due process, or Article 1, Section 9, when it bars a claim before it can be reasonably discovered? And I think Mako's holds it cannot, and I think Tomczyk, by implication, holds it cannot, because Tomczyk says the difference in this case is that it was discovered before the statute of repose was imposed. So that what we're attacking is the statute of repose under 893.56. Because the statute of repose on 893.55 doesn't apply here. Because it's whichever is later. And what the defendant wants to do, that because Mako's came down and said we don't like the 5-year statute of repose for a number of different reasons, they want to try to enforce the 1-year discovery rule like that second part of the sentence doesn't exist. And we've gotten into a briefing of whether or not it's divisible out of the statute, but I submit that doesn't really matter. Because the way the statutes read, it doesn't matter. The whole question is this, I think the question is, number one, is this court going to stick with the basic mandate of Maples that if you can't reasonably discover your injury within the statute of repose, the statute can't be applied? I think it's also the reasonable discussion in Tomczyk that if you do discover it reasonably within the statute of repose, the statute of repose is enforceable. Timmy, that's...
Help.
Yes?
I'm sorry. Do you have more to say on that?
I did, but I forgot it, so go ahead.
That argument, although focused on the statutes before us, 55 and 56, 93, really, there would be no logical distinction between this statute of repose and any other of the myriad of other statutes of repose. Is that correct from a whether it's a 1-9 due process or equal protection argument, really?
In many ways, yes, because I think the holding of Mako's, or the mandate of Mako's together with Tomczyk, is the issue is whether or not the person reasonably discovers the injury within the statute of repose. There are some differences, however, because although the court in Mako's did not discuss equal protection, the dissenters in Tomczyk did, and this statute violates equal protection rules up and down the board. The clearest one is that what's the statute of repose or limitation or whatever for kids under disability?
Let me, just before you get into that, because that's an interesting issue, I just want to make sure I've got this in my mind nailed. That is, the premise that a statute of repose is, for whatever reason, unconstitutional, if it bars a claim before it can be reasonably discovered, that premise would apply not only to a statute of repose in medical malpractice, but I remember previously looking at the statutes of repose, many of which I had never seen in my life, that are stuck in other kinds of causes of action. That rationale necessarily applies to any statute of repose that would bar a claim before it can be reasonably discovered. Am I correct or incorrect?
In tort law, yes. In contract law, no.
Because of,
So it depends if it's a tort or not. If the court has drawn that distinction in CLL.
The discussion in Tomczyk, which related to the surveyors, which upheld that statute.
Yes.
even though it might have caused, it might have, without, and it upheld it without a discovery rule, that a discovery rule was not needed.
Well, I looked at time check, as you might believe, very carefully, and the court, the court notes in a footnote that the plaintiffs there discovered their injury in June, and they didn't file suit, or they were barred on August 25th of the same year, so they had, that's why I said they had it between 7 and 12 weeks or so to file suit.
And they made that argument specifically in terms of Article 1, Section 9.
Correct.
But they went to a lot of trouble saying, hey, discovery doesn't apply to the survey, to surveyor, and that, that as a constitutional matter, the legislature didn't have to apply a discovery rule.
Well,
I mean, that was criticized by some of the concurrences in the sense, but that's what the majority, I think, said.
But I don't know how...
It's all dicta?
Well, of course, because they had discovery. It would have been a closer call if they discovered it 2 days before the statute was
applied. You don't feel bound by time check.
I feel time check is a decision that really, again by dicta, is much in our favor because it distinguishes the two concepts. I agree that one of the concurring opinions, or one of the opinions of the court, references that we don't have, the legislature doesn't have to impose a discovery rule, but a discussion about discovery really was not relevant since discovery was had. The question was, did the legislature have to give them more than 7 to 12 weeks? And apparently, the court believed that that was a proper time period. But I want to point out that this statute, which has been a bane for lawyers in this field, provides no equal protection to children under developmental disability. Everyone assumes that we go to 893.16 and kids under developmental disability have 2 years beyond 18, but that isn't true because the 893.16, which gives everyone else 2 years beyond majority and would presumably give developmental disabled children 2 years beyond majority, by its wording does not apply to medical malpractice action.
Counsel, can you attack that since you're client, I don't think, is under suffering disability. I just don't know the rule of law.
Yeah, under Funk versus Willen, stores it somewhere in here. Yes, the site on that, it's Funk versus Willen Silo, 148 West 2nd 59. That was one of the initial discussions of the court on whether or not it's allowed to attack a statute on unconstitutionality, even though it doesn't directly affect this claimant because this claimant is being injured by the statute. That's the question. If the statute is otherwise enforceable against this Amy and her and the injury and claim she has, then anything that makes the statute unconstitutional is fair game. And it, clearly, the statute and the statutory scheme discriminate against the developmentally disabled. And as you will see in our appendix, near the end, I'm sorry I don't have that page, I had it folded over. We cite to the court a case where a mental disability is considered to be, to go on the strict standard scrutiny, discriminated against people who are mentally handicapped. So it's not even the reasonable standards test. But the statute discriminates unfairly in other ways, too. The 9-year-old is discriminated against unfairly. And why is 9 different than 7? In fact, a 6-year-old is treated differently than 4. What is it about a birthday that makes, that's the magic? Also, children between 10 and...
Yeah? There's a lot of laws that deal with birthdays. You can't drink before you're 21, but you can be, you can vote. So there's nothing magic about any age. You just pick an age, and if it's close enough, it's good enough.
Well, what I'm leading to, though, is that one of the things we're supposed to do is look at a class of people and see if they're being treated the same. The class here are children who are disabled according to the legislative process from bringing their own suit. No child can bring a suit in this state. Child has to have an adult bring that suit. So the children are all in the same class. They're injured by medical malpractice. That's the class. I recognize I can't go outside that class. A 12-year-old is treated different than 9, 9 different than 7, 7 different than 4. Developmental different than what I'll call normal. There's a number of discriminations within the statute that I think are inappropriate and improper. The what does a 12-year-old have that he should be or she should be treated as an adult? for that matter, a 9-year-old is treated as an adult, an 8-year-old is, a 7-year-old is, and depending when the injury is, it could be any of the children are treated like adults within reason. I mean, it's possible to apply this 10th birthday statute in a discriminatory fashion against children in a number of different ways depending on when their injury occurred.
What's the age for criminal prosecution for a child?
I don't have a clue.
Young.
It may well be.
Well.
I always thought it was 14, but I'd be speaking as a layperson.
Okay.
Not, I don't practice in that field at all. But I do think that when you don't allow children to bring their own suit, it's suspect when you then treat them also differently. But I do think the primary problem with this statute, yes?
Do we necessarily have to reach the constitutional question, either the equal protection or the Article 1, Section 9? Can we look at the language of the statute, 56? Injuries to the person arising from any treatment or operation performed by a healthcare provider, and interpret that to mean discovery that the injury, that there was an injury, rather than simply another kid whose eyes are failing, but that there was an injury caused by a healthcare treatment provider, and that you brought your action within 3 years of the date that you discovered it.
Yes, I think that's appropriate, especially considering the concurring opinions in Makos. This doctor...
Well, what
this
about, let's just stay with that, what about the language of 2, that 1B, that is the discovery rule? Now, we in Hansen added a discovery rule to the statute. And we said this is what it is, I'm discovering. But how can you read 1, if that's what, maybe I misunderstood Justice Babbitt's question, how can you read discovery into 1 when discovery is provided for by the legislature in B?
Because I would maintain that because this statute describes any treatment or operation. Amy was not injured by any treatment or operation. She was injured by lack of treatment.
It says, or from omission by a person who is a health care provider. That's line 3. Treatment or injury or from any omission. Now, there was omission here.
I would agree there is omission.
That's right. So I don't see how you do it. Now, we asked you, and I hate to bring back a sore point, although you wanted Makos, I guess.
Sort of.
For the moment. And we asked you in Makos whether you could distinguish between... care on the one hand and diagnosis on the other. And you said no. Remember that?
No, I think I said I thought I could distinguish it, but I thought Martin may be the problem, that there wasn't a distinguishment made under informed consent. I certainly can distinguish between diagnosis, lack of treatment, treatment, care. I have a problem distinguishing omission, except that it is preceded arising from any treatment or operation performed by or for any admission by a healthcare provider.
Omission has to be lack of it. Go ahead.
Shouldn't your answer to Justice Abraham, to the Chief's concern, be that the words "whichever is later" has already ruled out 55? And so that we're still, which is the argument that you made 15 minutes ago, and so that we are bound by the provisions of 56, and 56 talks about injuries caused by the treatment, and they didn't know.
There's no question that I believe we're only in 56, and the only reason that MAKOS is important is because if MAKOS held that statute of reposes that are enforced before one can reasonably discover the injury, if that's the law of MAKOS, at least in the diagnosis case, that's the law, then that same rule of law should apply to 56. It's a medical malpractice action. It's a statute of repose. And typically, if he hadn't noted in his records, it would be a failure to diagnose. It appears that he diagnosed it, but either forgot about it or didn't know you could follow up on it.
Counsel, true. An omission appears in 56 too.
Right, but what we don't know, Justice Abramson, is Chief Justice, is does by the any person arising from who's injured, isn't the word injury been interpreted by this court as meaning when you discover you're injured? In any other discussion of statute of statute limitations, the word injury is when you reasonably discover you're injured. You're not. I mean, in theory, one could lose an organ and be physically injured 4 years ago and discover that now, and that's when the court has ruled my injury occurs.
I just ask you one question. Do you think that the legislature can do away with the judicial doctrine of discovery?
Under Hansen, they may well be able to do that.
Right.
But I don't think the legislature can do away with the doctrine that to bar a person's claim before they've reasonably discovered it is constitutionally allowable. And I want to point that up, too. Although in MAKOS there is this disparate opinions, it is incorrect to say that the justices who took the this is a diagnosis case, so the statute doesn't apply. Those justices didn't find the statute constitutional. Those justices just didn't address that issue because they didn't think it necessary, which, of course, is the first step of the court. Is it necessary, or does plaintiff's claim survive some other way? If once one decides as a court that, well, we're stuck with 56, then looking at Tomczyk as well as MAKOS, you have to decide whether or not it's within the guidelines of either due process, equal protection, or Article 1, Section 9 to enforce a statute of repose against a person who did not reasonably discover their claim within the time limit of the statute of repose.
One more question. Do you concede that you don't fall within 1A or B, that you did not bring the action within those time periods? Of 55. Or even 56, that is within by the time she was 10.
I can only answer on two ways. One, the answer I already gave, that I don't think 55 applies because by its wording it doesn't apply, and by 56 doesn't apply. But you understand that. The answer to the question is, I don't know about 1B because the issue never was brought up about when we finally got the records or when they were told by the ophthalmologist. But the 5 years would bar me.
Okay, the 5 years would bar you anyway.
Right. So
you're out.
I wish I was. I guess one of the advantages of having so many justices look at a case versus just a couple lawyers is I never thought about whether or not we actually might have filed it within 1 year of when the ophthalmologist told them. I think not, because I don't think we got the case that quick. I mean, I think they were told that, and you know what happens. One of the problems with the 1 year discovery rule is contrary to public opinion, it's tough for people to sue their doctor, and then when the doctor's dead, it's even tougher, and they're more worried about trying to get help for their kid, and then they got all their neighbors saying you're bad if you sue doctors. It takes time, and so I would be surprised if we got suits started within the 1 year.
Counsel, I, in reading your brief, know what you did or didn't argue, and I pulled my MAKOS file, since it seems to be kind of thick, and part of the transcript of that, and I remember really plugging into what you were thinking here on this distinction between diagnosis and treatment, which is the statutory argument. You didn't brief or argue the statutory argument.
True.
In MAKOS. In fact, you thought that, after all, diagnosis without treatment is meaningless. They're intimately intertwined. Diagnosis and treatment are so intertwined that any distinction made between them is one without a difference, and it would be inconsistent with Martin. That's what you were pushing. I note you don't make any statutory argument here. Why not?
Well, either because I missed it or because I adopted the terminology of omission and felt this was omission. And also, probably the number one reason, as I reflect, is the doctor made the diagnosis here. If that statement hadn't been in his records, this would have been a non-diagnosis case. But he made the diagnosis.
Well, much like my sense in your idea of not a misdiagnosis is an omission. I mean, that was... I think that's the way you got into the statute before. Maybe you don't.
No. Well, misdiagnosis probably is an omission, and we don't have omission in the other statute. But more importantly, here the doctor made the diagnosis, and then probably, unless he was just completely didn't know what he was doing, he probably forgot about it.
Omitted doing anything about it.
Then. Yeah, exactly.
So, where is the statutory? Let me be blunt. If you don't make a statutory argument, it seems to me that you're suggesting there's not a statutory argument worth making.
Well,
all attorneys here are good. I mean, we've got some high-caliber attorneys arguing this case. Why didn't you make a statutory argument in this case?
I think I answered, but I have made some statutory arguments, to be clear. But my feeling is that although it says any treatment or operation, it doesn't say lack thereof, it says, or for any omission by a health care provider, I would have thought in my own mind they could have covered the waterfront better than they covered it in sub 2 of 89355. But I have made a clear statutory argument that under the statutes as they read, 55 clearly does not control this situation. And I don't think that's even a subject to reasonable debate. I don't think either defense counsel or the court could take a magic marker and cover up the five-year rule and say, even if it is severable, it doesn't matter because it still doesn't mean that you don't apply 56 because it says whichever is later. So you'd have to black out two parts of the statute. And that's why I think the issue is a real simple issue, and that issue is, will the court enforce a statute of repose where a party has not reasonably discovered their injury within the time period of the repose? MAKOS said no, and I think Tomczyk implies no.
What good is a statute of repose if it must contain a discovery rule in order to be constitutional?
Well, I guess that's something to be taken up with the Constitution.
Well.
I mean, the Constitution in Article 1, Section 9, MAKOS, Tomczyk, and other cases, it's clear that that's the way it goes. Maybe the statute of repose, I mean, in Tomczyk, the statute of repose was enforced with about a 7 to 12 week discovery period in effect. That's one thing the statute of repose did. So, but it's not Amy's problem that the statute of repose disables the legislature from doing things that I find abhorrent, frankly.
So all statutes of repose are unconstitutional unless we graft on a discovery rule in the absence of the legislature having done so, which they're never going to do because that defeats the whole purpose of a statute of repose, right?
Well, I don't think it does because I think it can shorten the discovery of the injury to, right now, Martin said 1 day's too short, and Tomczyk said that 7 to 12 weeks is plenty of time. That's the word the court used in the footnote, plenty of time. So you wouldn't normally have a discovery rule that could be as short as 7 weeks. So the statute of repose does do some good, but we have a constitution in order to protect people against the writing of laws that don't allow them redress.
My time's up. Thank you.
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
Does the record reflect, Mr. Aiken, how many times Dr. Harris saw Amy?
I'm only aware of the one time, but you may well have seen this child numerous other times. I don't think we have the complete medical record in evidence. It may be in the court file. I don't know if it came up or not. My own impression would be that he probably stayed the child's pediatrician for some period of time, but that's hard to balance with the fact that he noted red reflex and didn't do anything about it. So I'm caught unable to to answer your question at this time.
Did Dr. Harris deliver the child?
I don't know that, but I know he did the newborn exam, which is where this is usually picked up, and indeed he did pick it up. It'd be a more difficult question if he hadn't picked it up, because this may be a diagnosis that can be missed from time to time, but he didn't miss it.
Let me rephrase the question. Was Dr. Harris the child's pediatrician?
My impression is yes, but I can't state that to a certainty. I'm not prepared. I thought of that actually this morning as I drove up by coincidence, and I started trying to reason through whether or not we ever found that out from the parents or if it was ever discussed in the mom's deposition. But he was dead by the time the child, I think, was somewhere between 4 and 6, I think. He may have retired, too. I just don't know exactly the total period of treatment. I could advise the court if you so wish. I'll look it up in the record.
Well, let me just see you hold that a bit. I gather, and I don't know, but we can take judicial notice, I assume, of some medical tests, maybe not, that this is a condition that can be diagnosed maybe in a one-shot deal. That is, see the child and whatever eye test you do, which is common at the birth of a child, test the eyes, that this is readily visible and the doctor can see it and do it. So
true.
Like taking some genetic tests, you know right away this child has a genetic problem, and that's it. It's not something that
it's not
can be detected by a test, a simple test.
It's my impression, and the record would reflect, I think defense counsel would agree, that number one, it is diagnosable early on. Two, it was diagnosed here. Three, it's treatable. Four, if it's treated, it's curable.
And the omission was the failure to refer to the pediatric ophthalmologist for treatment, evidently.
And just how about telling mom and dad this is a problem that has to be followed up on? There was no discussion with mom and dad about the subject either.
So that was an omission, too?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rosser?
I'd like to address right away the issue of what is an injury and when does an injury occur. I think the courts in the state have not said that an injury is when the cause of action is discovered. The injury occurs when there's an injurious change in the person's physical being. And I think there's certainly a Court of Appeals case, Foget versus Stoffel, which I'm aware of. It was a tubal ligation case where the date of conception was the date of injury for the medical malpractice statute.
Mr. Russell, why is this any different than that oil case? I don't even remember the name of it.
Borrello.
Borrello? Borrello.
Always reminds me.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that was case number 94-1743. Why is this any different than Borrello? Because they knew they were injured, but they didn't know the cause of their injury.
Well, I guess we'd have to look back at every single medical malpractice case that's discussed what an injury is, and they're all consistent. The Olson case, for example, which was a case that discussed about whether or not the person was injured regarding a blood transfusion and when that injury occurred, did it occur later when the interaction of the processes of the blood transfusion actually caused an injury, or was it at the time of the transfusion? And the court said it was at the time that the change occurred. And that same reasoning was then followed in Foget, by the Court of Appeals.
It strikes me that this is a case where, you know, kids with glasses, they see hundreds of kids with glasses around them. It's a common condition that some kids' eyes deteriorate through nobody's fault. And so at age 9 1/2, 10, 10 1/2, Amy discovers that her eyes have really deteriorated, and like thousands of other kids, thinks that this is nobody's fault, it's just due to her genetic makeup, and she's got bad eyes, like I did when I was 10 years old. But then, maybe 3 years later, she discovers that, hey, this was not a natural occurring condition. This was a condition that I am the victim of because a doctor didn't do what he was supposed to do 15 years ago. Isn't that what we're faced with here?
We're still faced with the decision of when did the injury occur, that's when the injury occurred. When did the change occur in the body, that's when the injury occurred.
So, and Hansen applies only to the date of injury, not to the causation of injury. Is that what you're saying?
No. Hansen says something a little different. And Hansen says that the cause of action accrues when you can put together a causal relationship from your injury to the injurious act.
But the law develops. That's why we're here. We're a law developing court, and we're, you know, here's an interesting case in which, even though she knew she had harm because she knew that she didn't have eyesight, she didn't know that that harm was caused by somebody who could have prevented it, allegedly.
That's correct. At the time she discovered that she was blind, I'm not arguing that she knew that it was through any fault of Dr. Harris or any healthcare provider. I think Mr. Aiken has submitted that it likely occurred, that discovery of that it was the result of somebody's omission likely occurred even before a year before this case was filed. Certainly, it's been my argument that the one-year discovery rule, which was created by the legislature, is severable, and it's severable not through any machinations, but if this court determines that 893.56 is unconstitutional because it barred this young lady's claim before she discovered it, and you would then in turn also have to find that 893.55 would be unconstitutional as applied under the same sort of circumstances, and those circumstances would apply here, that it was discovered more than 5 years from the act or omission. Then when you find those two statutes unconstitutional, you can still sever the discovery statute and say, I'm sorry, plaintiffs, claimants have to be more diligent. The legislature has said you must file your lawsuit within 1 year of discovery. The disability question, I think it's equally as plausible to say that a child who is disabled, developmentally disabled, has an unlimited period of time to file a lawsuit, that there is no statute of limitation which applies. I'm certain if Mr. Aiken had a client under that circumstance, that's what he would be arguing. They're accepted from the general statute of limitation by being under age 10. They're accepted from the age 10 statute of limitation by developmental disability, and there's no other statute of limitation which applies. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Russert. Thank you, Mr. Aiken. And that completes the hearing on 98-2955.
Have a nice summer, Mr.